With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. You're with Brian McClain on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hello there. Thank you for joining me for this live broadcast. I'm Brian McClain. This is the Brian McClain Show right here on today's News Talk TNT Radio. I want to get this message out to you at the top of this hour here. The inaugural conference of Australians for Science and Freedom brings together thinkers and community leaders to share learnings, formulate plans, and help establish new and emerging networks and organizations to restore a thriving Australian society founded on science and freedom. Join the exciting lineup of health professionals, scientists, economists, lawyers, journalists, and community leaders to discuss a range of hot issues, including healthcare policy, democracy, and human rights, also education, the media, and the role of grassroots organizations. The Australians for Science and Freedom Conference will be held at the University of New South Wales, High Street, Kensington, from 8:30 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Saturday, the 18th of November, and 8:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Sunday, the 19th of November, plus TNT Radio. That's right. We'll be broadcasting live from the conference. If you're in the area and you would like to attend, scienceandfreedom.org is the website. Now, I was just on with Steve Hook and Ken Cuccinelli in the previous hour here, and we were talking about our southern border. We're talking about threats, national security threats. And I really appreciate the conversation, those gentlemen. Hats off to you guys. Also had a spicy conversation in that hour, so you're going to want to go back and check out our conversation with Gene Valentino as well. Some differing opinions there, but it was a good conversation, so very glad to have been in on that. Now, with regards to that southern border, with regards to war, you know, I just want to say we have 100,000 people dying in this country because of fentanyl annually right now because of said open border. If that is not terroristic warfare, I don't know what is. 100,000 Americans. We've covered this story so many times. I just lost a family member to fentanyl, actually, not that long ago. So, you know, all of us are feeling this. Now, my family member did not die of, being a toddler and accidentally crawling on this stuff because there was some Fetty zombies doubling a daycare center with their little Fetty den. But we are losing toddlers. We're losing police officers. We're losing non-drug users, non-combatants, if you will, to this drug. 100,000 a year. And how is it getting here? Go back and listen to Steve and I's talk with Ken. It's getting here through an open southern border. Why is the southern border open? Because that's the policy from the administration and the administration running the DHS, which is the overarching entity over Border Patrol, ICE, and many other agencies that should be working on making sure our borders are secure. So they tell us 19 hijackers took down the World Trade Center buildings. They don't really tell us much about what happened to the other five buildings there that day, but we'll save that for another time. 3,000 people died. Was it 2,997 approximately, or maybe exactly? 100,000 a year. 100,000 Americans a year. Go to Philly right now. See the Fetty zombies. See the Trank Dope zombies. Literally rotting apart. And this trash, this chemical that's being used as chemical warfare, masquerading as a drug, is being allowed to be brought into this country unfettered by our own government. If that's not warfare, I don't know what is. We went and waged a war in the Middle East, in Afghanistan in particular, that lasted 21 years after those 2,997 souls were lost on 9/11. Where's the war against the cartel for allowing the deaths of 100,000 Americans a year? I don't know. It seems to be some sort of mainstream conservative talking point now. Oh, the fentanyl. No, the fentanyl, the 100,000 people a year. That is warfare. Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all the major social platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Gitter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time, aka 100,000 Americans a year being killed by chemical warfare, on today's News Talk TNT Radio.
Drilling down the details.
I feel more informed when I listen.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Well, from chemical warfare to birds, dozens of famous bird species will lose their familiar names in the coming months and years as part of a nationwide effort to eliminate monikers clouded by racism and to diversify bird watching. I can't believe I'm reading this. Here with the story, joining me now is TNT Radio news producer Adam Clark. Ruckus, what the bird is going on here?
Yeah. You know, remember that song, the bird is the word. This is more like the word of the bird. So the lefties love this. There's this giant woke campaign to sever ties with the past in the name of equity and inclusion. And it appears to be moving onward and upward, so to speak, completely unabated, even in the sciences. We have a new effort undertaken by the American Ornithological Society. They are the ones who are responsible for standardizing English bird names across the Americas. And they announced plans today, Wednesday, to ditch any bird classifications derived from a person's name, instead identifying them by their physical traits or their habitats. Isn't that like profiling? Just saying. Oh, God, I couldn't help it. Now, of course, whether or not this is going to fly with zoologists and the general public remains to be seen. All right, I'll stop with the stupid puns. All right, so obviously not all fowl are named after people, and not all fowl that are named after people are linked to unsavory histories, but we want to be, you know, better safe than sorry, right? So the undertaking mainly aims to purge names that are connected to racism, misogyny, and genocide. We'll just leave that thought aside for a second. That is according to the AOS. That's short for American Ornithological Society. So they are also looking to do things. They want to change the names of birds whose names are, quote, deemed offensive and exclusionary, end quote, like Tom. Like, you know, if, you know, we don't like the name Tom. Just kidding. AOS Executive Director and CEO Judith Scarl, a PhD, said about all of this in a statement, quote, "As scientists, we work to eliminate bias in science, but there has been historic bias in how birds are named and who might have a bird named in their honor. Exclusionary naming conventions developed in the 1800s clouded by racism and misogyny don't work for us today, and the time has come for us to transform this process and redirect the focus to the birds where it belongs," end quote. Similarly, the AOS president Colleen Handel said, quote, "There is power in a name, and some English bird names have associations with the past that continue to be exclusionary and harmful today. We need a much more inclusive and engaging scientific process that focuses attention on the unique features and beauty of the birds themselves. Everyone who loves and cares about birds should be able to enjoy and study them freely, and birds need our help now more than ever," end quote. Isn't this cute? The naming purge will likely affect starting approximately 70 to 80 different bird species in the U.S. and Canada, though the process is only in its early stages. The AOS's decision comes after years, unbeknownst to me, of mounting pressure from the birdwatching or birding community to revoke the recognition of racist historical figures whose names were bestowed upon the fowl. That means that the Audubon's shearwater, a seabird native to the southeastern United States, will no longer be linked to John James Audubon, the founder of the eponymous New York City birding community and slave owner who opposed abolition. Audubon's own organization voted in March to drop its problematic founder's name, citing his legacy of white supremacy. So I think you see where this is going. The Audubon's Shearwater's new name will likely reflect its coastal habit or its identifiable rounded wings, similar to how the blue-footed booby is named for its iconic and unique teal flippers. Some birds have already undergone the change. Here's a couple. The thick-billed longspur, a small ground-feeding bird native to North America, was renamed in 2020 after nearly three centuries of being named for Captain John P. McCown, a Confederate soldier who, according to the AOS, is, quote, perceived today by many as a symbol of slavery and racism, end quote. This renaming pilot project will kick off next year in 2024 with an initial group of, 70 to 80 birds being reclassified here in the United States, as well as our neighbors to the north in Canada. The initiative, according to the AOS, will continue for months and years, with up to 260 birds due to be reviewed across the Americas and associated islands. So I guess they're dirty birds and they need to get their names washed out with soap. I don't know, Hesher. This is wild. What do you think?
These are bird-brained ideas. Equity and inclusion, that is for the birds, literally now, I suppose. You would think they might be more concerned about all of the birds dying, getting chopped up in windmills, perhaps, that aren't delivering any electricity that any of us can use. Never mind save the whales. Well, don't never mind that. They're dying too because of those things offshore, but we'll save that for another time. And what's this about the birding community asking for this? I mean, is there an X.com, a group of woke birding community people with purple hair who are extremely interested in birding and making sure that it's already hard enough, Ruckus, to know the names of birds? That's why they call it birding and make a hobby out of it and have all these books so you can learn to identify them. It's kind of like looking for mushrooms, right? It takes years to learn all the birds. What about the real birding community that's out there? And they've spent the last two decades birding and they know all the names of all the birds. I guess this is kind of like just wokeism leaking into the bird watching community. I'm not surprised. I'm wondering if there's like NGOs involved. I'm guessing there's probably multiple NGOs, university, academic types. And furthermore, Ruckus, what is going to happen? This is an important one. What is going to happen to Heckle and Jekyll? What is going to happen to Tweety Bird? What is going to happen to the Roadrunner? We've got so many beloved birds. Woodstock from Peanuts. Are they all going to have to be Androjo birds now? I don't know.
No, not those kinds of names of birds, Hesher. I was kidding about Tom, but it just means that in right now, see, like right now, if you were hanging out with your bird watching buddies, which I know you do frequently, you may have noticed that when you point out that, hey, look, there's a Lewis's woodpecker, or hey, isn't that a Townsend's warbler? And say, I swear I saw an Anna's hummingbird earlier today, and people were looking at you funny, like you were some sort of dirty racist. It's because you are, because those are horrible names, and they're finally going to be changed. So no more of those.
All right. Well, I don't know. Maybe wokeism is truly for the birds. I kind of think we've been saying that for a while here. But thank you, Ruckus. Appreciate that one. That was intriguing, interesting, and full of whiskey tango foxtrot. This is the Brian McLean Show right here on today's News Talk TNT Radio.
TNT Radio's Lynn Shaw.
This is a rough week. If you are feeling this way, can you imagine how our kids are feeling, how our youth are feeling? My heart goes out to every single person affected. It's horrific. Let's separate, just for a second, politics from all of this. How frightened these children must be. Mothers, fathers, whether it's Israel, Palestine, seeing these images of mothers crying after their children, fathers, you know, carrying children's bodies. Right now in the United States, your children are seeing the worst of humanity, because if they have unlimited, unfiltered, unmonitored access to the internet, which most kids do, it's true. How do you explain this evil to your children? You cannot. You must address. You must provide them, because they're seeing it. I know they're seeing it. I know you're overwhelmed, but this is a major horrific event in the world, and you have to talk to the kids about it. Honest and open discussion, age appropriate. The best advice I can give, a lot of people reached out to me this week, how do we deal with our children, is to talk to them.
Lynn Shaw on TNT Radio.
The Light is Britain's far-right conspiracy theory paper spreading hate and vicious lies. No, that's just what the BBC say. The Light is the only national newspaper bringing you the real news and informed opinion on what's really going on today. You can subscribe, order copies, submit articles, and read back issues on our website, thelightpaper.co.uk, and see for yourself why the establishment are so worried about the uncensored truth getting out to people every month. The Light Paper. Not for right, just right so far. Thelightpaper.co.uk.
Today's News Talk Radio.
I do a lot of streaming radio.
I do a lot of free streaming.
TNTRadio.live.
Now, the case, State of Texas v. ATF, was brought by GOA, Gun Owners of America, Gun Owners Foundation, and the State of Texas to challenge the ATF rule that reversed years of determination surrounding pistols equipped with stabilizing devices. The ATF's new rule reclassified most pistols with stabilizing braces to what they call SBRs, short-barreled rifles. And then this comes with a number of things attached to it. It means the firearms will be regulated under the National Firearms Act, the dreaded NFA of 1934. It required owners of these guns to register their firearms with the ATF, submit to additional background checks, hand over passport pictures, and provide fingerprints. Joining us now with an update on this case is Texas State Gun Owners of America Director Wes Verdell. Wes, thank you for rejoining me on the program here. What's the latest with State of Texas v. ATF?
Hey, thanks for having me. So we just had a preliminary injunction. We originally had a preliminary injunction granted on 31st of May. And that was good. It covered all employees of the state of Texas that work for the state of Texas and current GOA members. We just had Judge Tipton extend the preliminary injunction last week. And now it includes anyone that resides in the house of a GOA member. So if you have, if you're a GOA member, we know for sure before October 27th, you're 100% covered from the ATF coming after you for your pistol braces at the moment. Doesn't mean they won't try. We all know they're tyrants. But it also, the language says current members. And so there's still kind of dispute on, does that mean if you joined after the date of that preliminary injunction? We can't guarantee that, but we do guarantee anyone that joined before 27 October is good to go. And you're possibly good to go if you joined after. We're just waiting on clarification. You asked 15 lawyers, same question, you'll get 15 different answers. So.
Of course, that's why we need you. So, well, that's pretty good news. And how do you think it's looking nationwide? I know you're doing a lot of work, and other people here in Texas doing a lot of work. What about on the national scale?
Yeah, so we have some great national people with Gun Owners of America, and on the national scale, we're winning some lawsuits, but we also have a challenge that every time we win something, the states and the federal government just go and try to do something else. And it costs lots of money to fight against the government and their overreach. And this always goes back to when our government was founded, and when many governments were founded, it's always for the purpose of a good moral reason, which is protect your rights, protect your property. We are now at the point, which happens to all governments, they start to transition to tyrannical. They start trying to take property from you and start trying to take away your firearms, disarm you. We are at that point now. We've seen it since 1934, but now we're seeing it egregiously coming after us. So we're at a point now where I feel like this is kind of the line being drawn in the sand, where we either got to win right now, or government is going to I don't want to say this, but we know what happened with Mao, Stalin, and Hitler, and what they did after they disarmed the people. And I think that's very possible here in the States, that could be what would happen.
Yeah,
it may not be quickly, but it could happen. Yeah, so
go ahead. Oh, go ahead. Yeah, it could happen very fast, especially when we see the reaction from the highly politicized events. And we've been seeing them for a long time now. And, you know, my colleague Steve Hook just did an interview earlier today with Sheila Matthews. And she's tracking all of the psychotropic and, you know, SSRI style drugs that so many mass murderers, she likes to call them mass murderers instead of mass shooters, because I mean, we got, there's so many ways you can be a mass murderer. And our government and our media tends to really jump on a highly, you know, divisive, politicized and sad event like that and go straight to trying to take away people's gun rights without even looking at, you know, the who, what, when, where, why, and how that would, you know, explain the tragic event that we just saw.
Yeah, this that information. So one of the worst things that we've had happen was them passing the Gun-Free School Zone Act of 1990. And if you look at all school shootings before 1990 and then school shootings since 1990, I mean, what they basically did is told every person that's struggling with mental illness, hey, here is a target-rich environment without anybody to fight back for it, to fight back against you. We're working on that here in Texas. We have the Guardian program, which allows trained teachers to carry. My goal next session, which is going to be in 2025, is that we push really hard for license to carry for teachers. So basically, if you're a teacher right now, you currently have to get permission from the school board to participate in the Guardian program. I want to bypass that to where basically we're usurping the, I think that's the right word, usurping the Gun-Free School Zone Act and basically putting armed people back on school where they can defend kids. And we want any bad person that has any bad intent to know if you come to the schools, you're going to find resistance and probably take you out. One of the things they're trying to do in Texas right now, they passed House Bill 3 this year. House Bill 3 requires that basically you have some form of armed person in the schools. The problem I have is I do want armed people in the schools to protect the kids, but I think we're getting to a point where public schools now look like little mini prisons. And you know, I don't know what it was like for you. When I grew up, schools weren't like that at all. And anyways, now I think that you're indoctrinating kids into growing up in these little mini prisons where they, for the rest of their life, they're going to think they always have to have somebody guarding them instead of being their own form of self-defense or anything like that. So basically, I want to make sure that the kids don't feel like they're in prisons, and I want to make sure that people are there to defend those kids. Uvalde was terrible example, and unfortunately it happened, and unfortunately it happened in Texas, and that school could have utilized the Guardian program, and they didn't do that, and you saw what happened. And then you saw when law enforcement got there, they took over an hour to go in. I think the number I heard was that there was 400 law enforcement officers on that campus by the time it was over, which great that many showed up, but you know, unfortunately it took an hour for them to go in. We have to be able to be there immediately and to take care of the threat immediately. I've been through the Guardian training, and it's a great training where it's actually teaching teachers to engage with the active shooters and how to take them out and how to work with other teachers into taking those bad guys out. We need more of that, and we need to get the school boards out of the way where you don't have to get school board permission, because most of the liberal schools or the bigger schools aren't utilizing this Guardian program. It's mostly rural schools right now that are using it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's very important right there. You know, and I've talked to a couple of teachers who have told me that when they do some of their active shooter drills, that the teachers themselves don't even know, like they have kind of like when you and I were kids, like we had fire drills, right? And sometimes the teacher would be like, oh, they didn't tell me, but you know, sometimes they don't tell us so that we'll you know, hop too. And it's like, for a fire drill, yeah. I kind of understand that. But when you are a teacher and you hear the siren or you get the text or whatever the warning system is, you immediately go into an elevated state of fight or flight, and that reflects on the children. I think that this is, I mean, I don't know, correct me if you think I might be wrong, but I think this is a slightly terroristic and the kind of thing that will make a whole generation of people gladly give up their Second Amendment right.
Yeah, I think that's, fear is a great motivator to get people to look what happened during COVID. You know, fear was used there, and people just, I was really disappointed in my country, to be honest with you, during COVID.
Me too.
I thought surely people are going to stand up against this and not bow down to it. And we watched a ton of people bow down to the government mandates, to the mask mandates, to the vaccine mandates. And I get people didn't want to lose their jobs, and so they were complying. But guess what? That fear is what caused compliance. And when you comply with tyranny, you're going to be the slave of that tyrant. So I hope, and I really hope that people really learned a lesson here. And I know some people are embarrassed by that, they cower down to it. But I hope that next time something like this comes up, that nobody forgets about COVID and they refuse to bow down to tyranny.
Me too. You know, I'll never forget rolling into Buc-ee's, you know, in like April of 2020, and just being like me and my lady, the only two people in there without the ritual muzzle of shame. And it's just like, this is a huge full place and everybody's doing it. And then you start wondering about the jab uptake and all that. And you're right, there's a lot of buyer's remorse these days. But I still, when I go to Buc-ee's, I still see that 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 people wearing the muzzle of shame around. And I got to wonder, like, what's going to happen next time? And they're telling us there will be a next time. They're definitely working on that with their whole pandemic treaty that the WHO is working on and stuff. Hold the line there, Wes. We're going to take a headline here. We got an inbound headline with today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
News flash.
TNT Radio
this
News.
This is James O'Neill with a check of today's headlines. 400 Americans are on an approved list to be allowed to go to Egypt in the second day of evacuations out of Gaza. Some wounded Palestinians have also been allowed out. Officials in Gaza say the number of Palestinians killed tops 9,000. Lieutenant Colonel Richard Hecht, the IDF's international spokesman, told CNN on Tuesday evening that the decision to bomb a refugee camp in Gaza was justified, to take out a very senior Hamas commander in that area.
On air and on the app.
I listen on the app.
Stay up to date around the clock.
I listen, therefore I know.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, Gun Owners of America is definitely one of the things that you should be supporting if you're an American. I'll just put it that flatly. If you're an American and you value your country and you value your Constitution not being trashed and crapped upon, you should definitely be a member at Gun Owners of America. I'm not a paid sponsor, just a paying member and a very happy one. I'm with Wes Verdell here. Wes, I want to ask you about legislation that died in Texas this session. But first, I'll take your comments on, you know, if you have any further comments on just tyranny and this, you know, further iterations of COVID or something similar we might be facing.
Yeah, real quick, back to the Buc-ee's that you mentioned. I am in a Buc-ee's parking lot right now, so.
All right.
But most convenient place to do a little interview. And now on the tyranny or the fear stuff and all that, you know, we have legislators that are leading. I say leading, they're not really leading, but they are in a position to make decisions and they have fear in their hearts. And anytime that you have somebody in a leadership position with fear in their hearts, they're going to screw everybody over. That's what's going on right now. We have to replace the people that are there that are making decisions because of fear. When COVID happened, we watched all the legislators. I think out of 150 in the House, I think there were 3 guys that stood up against the COVID mandates and the rest of them bowed down. We have to have more people that will stand up, and we have to quit sending people up there that have fear in their hearts. Like, if you want effective leaders, you have to find people who are willing to have the courage to stand up. And I feel like we're lacking that a lot of times lately.
Yeah, very much.
As far as legislation goes. Yeah. As far as legislation goes that died, my favorite bill was the HB 2705. That was a bill to get rid of the short-barreled weapons this season, because we're dealing with the pistol brace ban. And it was a way to improve Texas and put us in a stance where we can resist that tyranny, and Texas could possibly stand up for fight for us. So it was to remove short-barreled weapons from the prohibited list in the penal code in Texas. And that bill unfortunately died. It got to calendars and never made it to the House floor to be voted on. It would have had to go to the Senate floor after that, but it died. And one of the things that's really frustrating is every time they tell you, oh, we ran out of time, you know, we couldn't get to the bill. It was really frustrating because they can get to these bills, but they take 4 and 5 day weekends. I think they're just they're in special session right now, and they just adjourned for a 4 or 5 day weekend or something like that, and haven't got anything done in 3 weeks of this special session. So it's really frustrating. A lot of times, you know, we've been dealing with the Democrats being appointed to chairs, and then they kill our bills that we want to see pass. And then they can go back home and tell their constituents, hey, our bills died because the Democrats killed it. What they don't tell you is that they all voted for the Republican Speaker of the House that put that Democrat in that position. So, you know, really, it's kind of like, I feel like my job right now is one is fighting for the gun rights, and two is trying to expose here's why our bills are getting killed. So we see that happen quite a bit. We did have a great bill get passed this session, which was HB 2837. And we worked with Representative Matt Schaefer, who filed it for us, did a fantastic job. There was some back and forth on the language between us and some other gun groups. Got it passed, and basically it puts a restriction on credit card companies where it makes it a lot harder for them to code your purchase as a firearm purchase, because they're trying to track and create a database of your firearm purchases. And this puts a restriction on them where every time that they make a merchant category code, which is how they code your purchases for a firearm transaction, by law now they have to notify the constituent or the citizen that they did that. It becomes a logistical nightmare, an admin nightmare for them to do that. So that's the way we approach that bill. And I think it works great. I still think that the credit card companies are going to try to screw firearm owners and firearm dealers and everything else over somehow. You know, once again, it goes back to, it's really sad that when we have these major companies that are being run by liberals right now, and they're betraying everything that this country stood for. So
it is. It's probably highly frustrating. Yeah. Very, very frustrating.
They'll probably cancel my bank account.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Now, does that work for Texans who are making online purchases, or is it just brick and mortar in the state of Texas?
That's a great question. I have to go back and look on that, but I think it's any purchase within Texas. So I don't know if somebody, you know, gets on the internet and makes a purchase out of state, if that would happen, but for sure, if it happens within the state of Texas, they have to do it. And they tried to fight us on it. They tried to claim that they weren't the ones that made these merchant category codes. And what was great is we had Senator Charles Perry and Senator Schwartner. I'm trying to think who else. There was another senator there too that was helpful when this bill was being heard in committee in the Senate. And they basically pointed out to the lobbyists for the credit card companies, hey, you guys actually do this. It's right here on your website. So it was great to see those senators stand up for that and help us get it through. So.
Excellent. I love to hear that. I love to hear that, because I know there's so many veils to peer through for you there when you're down at the Capitol working this stuff. Now, we've got about 4 minutes left, so I got two more things I want to cover if we can squeeze them in. What do you want to get past next season? And I'm hearing rumors that you might be running for some sort of office.
I am. So for next season, I want to get our short-barreled weapon removed from the prohibited list. We'll push really hard on that one. We'll push really hard on getting the, whatchamacallit, sorry, just went blank there. Oh, license to carry for teachers. If you have an LTC and you're an employee, we want to push really hard on that becomes legal in school districts, so that you have more armed people there. And we're not saying everybody should carry. We're saying that people should have the choice to carry if they want to. And then the other thing is, yep, I'm running for office. I'm running against the guy that was leading the Attorney General Ken Paxton impeachment, who wasted possibly $10 million of taxpayer money, presented no evidence, swore that there was going to be mounds of evidence. He did zero witness or zero sworn testimony whenever they were doing the investigation, and then forced it through the House, brought it to the Senate, and then didn't present anything. And they had the witnesses on the stand actually saying we didn't have any evidence when we went to the FBI about this. So
unreal. That's Andrew Murr, right?
Yep, that is the guy with the mustache. Mm-hmm. looks like Snidely Whiplash.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and that Paxton witch hunt was so egregious, you know, and I was really not surprised to see it happen because he did such fantastic work in the midterm elections. I mean, I think he put out a dozen different lawsuits during the midterm elections to make sure that, you know, our votes here in Texas were not as vulnerable. I'll be nice about it here. Yeah. I'll use my journalistic term, as vulnerable as they are in other states. It was just, yeah. I mean, I watched his speech at the Heritage Foundation, and I was so impressed with the lengths that he went and the candidness with which he described why he had to go to those lengths to protect our votes here in Texas, especially in the big urban counties.
Yeah, it's really disappointing. And the legislature had the opportunity. So they took away, the Supreme Court took away Attorney General's office to go in and investigate election fraud in counties. And the legislature had the opportunity to pass a bill to fix that, and they chose not to do it. So now we're still sitting where an attorney general can't even go look into counties about election fraud.
Oh, boy. So we're going to be in the same battle in 2024, probably, I assume then.
Yep. Yeah, 100%.
Oh, wow. All right. Well, and do you have a website for your representative run? Is there anywhere I can point people?
Yeah.
Where are you at?
Yeah, our website's verdell4texas.com, or you can just Google Wesley Verdell or West Verdell, and any donations, we appreciate it. We're not funded by Austin lobbyists, and so we basically depend on voters to actually donate and help us win this race. And we know my opponent's going to spend $500,000 plus. He did last time, and so we're going to have to raise as much as we can to take this guy out and get him out of office.
It's really important. It's really important. And I'm really glad you're doing it. I don't know where you find time to do this on top of everything that you're already doing. Really, really appreciate your perspective and all of the work that you do. Again, Gun Owners of America, highly, highly recommend you become a member. Look what's happened right here in Texas. I mean, you're actually protected from a tyrannical ATF redefinition that has aims to take your private property or fine you, or even worse, if that were to go through. Okay, Wes, again, the website there was verdellfortexas.com, right?
Yes, sir. That's it.
All right. That's V-I-R-D-E-L-L for Texas.com. Any parting thoughts before I have to let you go, Wes? Really appreciate your time.
No, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. Good to be here.
All right. Yeah, we'll do it again real soon. Always appreciate seeing you. And hey, if you're up near my Buc-ee's, maybe I'll meet you at the Pistol Club later. I'll see if we can get down there this evening. All right. Wes Verdell right here on the Brian McClain Show at Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
Nothing screams insecure like a balding man wearing a toupee, a man with gray hair dyeing his hair, or a short man wearing lifts in his shoes. So with his campaign foundering and taking on more water than the Titanic did after it hit that iceberg, Ron DeSantis has apparently decided to put the final nail in its coffin all by himself. And while Florida has a modest-sized beef industry, one doesn't think cowboy culture when you think of the Sunshine State. So people were understandably perplexed by Ron's sudden footwear fashion choice of cowboy boots. And at the same time, people, including Vivek Ramaswamy, Donald Trump, and others, noticed that Ron appeared slightly taller in recent appearances than he had previously. Could Ron be wearing lifts in his cowboy boots, standing on tiptoe inside them, essentially turning them into high heels? We're not certain, but it certainly looks that way. And if it's true, Ron DeSantis is without question the most insecure Republican looking to finish second to Donald Trump in the Republican primary. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Many power grids worldwide are in grave danger of collapse from the growing amount of intermittent power sourced from wind turbines. Covering the countryside and offshore coastal regions with wind turbines is insane. English journalist James Dellingpole has described wind farms as a cancer and that he wants to raise public awareness of just how disastrous these bat-chomping, bird-slicing eco-crucifixes are in every single respect. These remarks nail the reality of wind farms to a T. When the wind doesn't blow, there is no power. And when gale force winds hit, the turbines are shut down. It's a Goldilocks moment. When the winds are just right, the power produced is at an optimum. In reality, industry and households require power 24/7, not just when the wind blows.
Brian McClain is Hesher, and both are on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Now, when I discuss firearms and news related to them, I do my best to be objective, even though I have a pretty strong bias. As we've seen, almost every time there's a tragic and highly politicized event, civilian disarmament brigaders and the David Hogg-esque influencers all start clamoring to restrict our Second Amendment rights. of law-abiding Americans. I'm not a fan of knee-jerk legislation being proposed or passed in the wake of violent incidents. I think it's very distasteful, especially when the media and the law enforcement and the government tend to suppress a lot of the relevant context in these events. Now, when things like what happened in Maine occur, I like to bring on an expert who can speak to the legal aspects and help us keep an air of objectivity. Joining me now is Washington Gun Law President William Kirk. William, it's great to see you again. I'm really curious if you could tell us a little bit about yellow flag laws, because I honestly hadn't even heard of a yellow flag law. I've been so focused on red flag laws and how I don't want them for so long. And then this event happened and I saw you did a wonderful video on it. By the way, YouTube, Washington Gun Law, if you're not already subscribed. William, go ahead.
Thank you. Yeah, Brian, thanks for having me. Well, you know, I had not really heard much about yellow flag laws. We have red flag laws out here in the People's Republic of Washington, or what we call extreme risk protection orders. What actually got to take a look a little of history. In 2019, there was a significant push by those who favor civilian disarmament for red flag laws. And what the legislature shockingly did is they struck a compromise. And I know that's a dirty word in today's day of politics, but they came up with a compromise where, in addition to law enforcement making the initial petition on a person that they believe might be a danger to themselves or other, once that petition is accepted by the court, they then bring mental health professionals in and do an independent kind of evaluation of this person and then present all of that evidence to the court. And the burden of proof is actually clear and convincing evidence. So it's a higher burden of proof than what we're used to seeing in red flag laws. And as I've said on my channel many times, I do understand the need for red flag laws or something similar to that. I think that many lawful and responsible gun owners agree that we need to keep guns out of the hands of people who should not be having them. And even no matter how noble the purpose is of red flag laws, when we implement them, that's when we run into all sorts of constitutional problems, because candidly, they thwart numerous constitutional rights of the people who are subject to those orders.
Yeah, just to kind of jump to the thing that you said in that video that really hit me, you what you just alluded to, the bigger issue here, it does not matter how good of a law you write if you have a system that's not enforcing them. And what do we see across the nation? We see, I mean, in Los Angeles, for goodness sakes, the LAPD, they can't even hit someone with a gun charge right now. If they catch a known criminal with an illegal gun, I don't even think they can arrest them for it. Or if they do, they're out on a no cash bail.
Well, yeah, and we saw, you know, those who favor civilian disarmament immediately start decrying Maine's laws as being too weak and too futile, and just saying that we need to implement more strict red flag laws. But as I mentioned on that video, I don't care how many laws you pass. When nobody's willing to inject themselves into this equation, there were hundreds of people in Maine who came across in the path of this lunatic who had ample information to disclose to law enforcement that could have commenced an investigation. This person was a firearms instructor. A lot of people knew that, which means he's got an access to firearms. It's like, I'm sure my golf instructor has a lot of golf clubs lying around his house. Okay. So not only do we know he has access to firearms, he's probably pretty proficient at them, and he's exhibiting all sorts of signs of severe mental anguish, and nobody ever says a word.
Yeah, it makes no sense.
It doesn't matter how good your law is. It does not matter how good your law is. It would have never saved a life if no one's willing to step up and say something.
Right. It could have been a red flag law and nobody said anything. And when there was an incident and he did have to go involuntarily, if I recall, into mental health care.
Right.
Where are the psychologists and the psychiatrists that treat these people? Almost every mass shooter we've seen has had some sort of history of, you know, mood altering, SSRI, et cetera, et cetera. And there's also a psychiatrist and or psychologist in the mix, and we never hear from those people.
Well, and think about in this case in Maine is this individual was involuntarily committed for a 2-week stay. Now, as a defense attorney, I unfortunately have had some clients that have gone down that road. Typically, you're going to see a 72-hour stay max. So 2 weeks kind of says, hey, this problem was pretty acute at that point. Clearly, there were some professionals who would have had interactions with him, would have learned, oh, this person is a firearms instructor who's going through all of this mental turmoil. And nobody. And the minute, you got to remember, the minute he's involuntarily committed under federal law, he is now ineligible to possess firearms. Okay, the very minute he was checked into that mental health facility, under federal law, he is prohibited from having firearms. Did anybody along the way make a phone call and say, hey, you guys might want to check this out? Nope.
Yeah. No, nothing happened. And this is a person where many people knew he had mental health issues. He was displaying odd behaviors, telling people he was hearing voices, making threats to shoot
places up. I mean,
yeah,
what better risk assessment can you have than someone promising to go shoot a place up?
I don't know. It seems like there are so many points of failure here where all of the structure is there to have avoided this, but it's like everything fell through the cracks here. Well, and this guy, like you said, he was already disqualified from possessing a firearm the second he was committed.
That's right. And, you know, Brian, not only was there a massive failure on part of all of these people who could have intervened, because I don't believe that the Maine legislative scheme let the state of Maine down here. I think the people surrounding this individual did. I'll tell you what else let all of these victims down was the establishment that decides that they're going to be a gun-free zone. Okay. Because yes. When we put signs up on doors of places that say firearms are not allowed, the only people who are going to obey those signs are the lawful, responsible gun owners. They're the ones that will go leave them in the car. Oh, I got to go put the thing back in the car. They're not, because they do follow the laws, right? And had there been just one armed person in there, you know, things may have turned out differently. At least the people in there would have had a fighting chance.
Yeah. That was my first thought when I heard the news. It was like, where are the armed defenders? This guy went to two, maybe three different locations. All these people, you know, he injured and killed. Just like, where are our armed defenders? Because I know Maine is a fairly, you mentioned they rate somewhat high on the scale as far as, you know, gun rights and safety.
Yeah, they're really kind of a middle of the road state. I think that this compromise that they came up with on their yellow flag law is actually, as I mentioned on the video, I think it's a much closer to being a constitutional model than what we see in a lot of other states. Their gun violence, but prior to this incident, their gun violence numbers is something that the governor of the state should be proud of. It's a state that's not as riddled with gun violence issues as many other states. This is a horrible, horrible situation that was absolutely preventable without having to pass any new gun laws.
Yeah. And as you point out, they just aren't going to work anyways. I mean, we just keep seeing these sort of things. Let's shift gears a moment here, because you've also flagged up something that you noted in the title of the video that not many people are paying attention to, which is, you know, I'm just south of Oklahoma, and it's my understanding that Oklahoma, I don't have the code to hand here, but it's my understanding that in Oklahoma, it is the only state in all 50 where your Second Amendment right is protected if you're a user of cannabis. I'm sure that's going to be contentious moving forward here, but you've been talking about this on your channel with regards to United States.
This is an issue I believe really strongly in. Maybe it's because I come from Washington State, where we legalized cannabis years ago, and despite the fact that our state is falling apart for lots of reasons, it is not legalized cannabis that's causing our demise here. So for your listeners here, if you don't know this, under federal law, if you are just even an occasional user of cannabis, you are technically not allowed to possess a firearm at any time during your life if you are an occasional cannabis user, which makes that very unique compared to some of the other drugs. You could have people who are completely strung out on painkillers. You could have the town drunkard who's only sober one day a week, and there will really be no prohibition on them obtaining firearms. But if you have an individual who smokes a joint once a month, especially in a state where cannabis is legal, they technically are prohibited from possessing a firearm. So if they go to buy a firearm, they have the Hobson's choice of either saying, yeah, I use cannabis, sales rejected, or lying on the form 4473. And there has been a real awakening in the appellate court since the Bruin opinion of last summer about, hey, how many of these laws do we have really have some historical precedent behind it? And there is a rich tradition of banning the possession of firearms by people who are actually intoxicated at that time. My state of Washington, you can't be intoxicated by alcohol and in possession of a firearm. But just because you get intoxicated or use alcohol on certain days of the week does not mean you're prohibited from possessing a firearm altogether. So we're beginning to see in like Daniels versus United States and some of these other cases, these relatively conservative courts actually going, hey, there's no historical tradition. And they're finding that portion of 18 U.S.C. 922 unconstitutional. It's up for review. The United States Supreme Court may accept review on the Daniels case. I am hopeful that they will. I think this is an issue. You have a lot of legalized cannabis states. You got many more, I think, that are kicking the idea around. And I think this is an issue that needs to be resolved.
Yeah, I totally agree, especially in the age of chemical warfare coming from the cartels on the southern part of the border, where we're losing 100,000 people a year to these fentanyl drugs, many of them not drug users who just accidentally came in contact with it. And then the ones that are drug users, look at Philadelphia. It's literally turned into a zombie apocalypse where they're mixing the tranquilizers with it. You've got people that are literally have pieces of their bodies rotting off and are dying in the streets. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. And the federal government always threatening to legalize cannabis federally, you know, bandying it about. And while it's, you know, become legalized either medically or recreationally in many states in the country now, I mean, it's really a convoluted message that I don't see how this can hold up in court anymore, at least in the Supreme Court.
I don't. And I think that, you know, taking the recreational cannabis users aside for a moment, let's talk about the medical users, because we have a horrific prescription painkiller problem in this country, which has led to all sorts of other problems. But we also have people who are seriously managing chronic pain for real. Now, if you have a patient who can manage chronic pain through the use of medicinal cannabis, there's not a single doctor who won't think that that's a lot better than running a bunch of opiates through your system. But now that patient has to choose between proper medical care and their right of self-preservation. No American should be put in that choice. And that's why these laws need to be revisited.
Absolutely. I mean, your Second Amendment right is a right of self-preservation also. So it's kind of like, which gun do you want to be shot with?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Do you want to go out on their terms or you want to go out on your terms? Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's two pieces of law here. There's 18 USC section 922N and then 922G3. Now, what are the differences between those?
Yeah. So here's what's going on. There's two cases that are up for invitation to the United States Supreme Court. The Daniels case that we already talked about, that's 18 USC 922 G3. That's the prohibition against those that use controlled substances. There's another case called Range versus Attorney General of the United States. And that deals with whether nonviolent felons should be losing their firearm rights for eternity. Mr. Range was accused of food stamp fraud back 30 years ago when he was a single dad raising three kids and just struggling mightily financially. So he fibbed a little on his income so he could stay on food stamps. And in Pennsylvania, that was a felony. He didn't serve a single day in jail or anything like that. 20 years later, Mr. Range can still no longer get a firearm. And so I think that the issue that's before the United States Supreme Court this month in Rahimi is a lot different. Mr. Rahimi is a violent felon. It's a whole different can of worms. But I think the nonviolent felons, the people who are out on, you know, white collar crimes and things such as that, are some of these drug users. I mean, we got a lot of people in their 20s did some stupid stuff. You know, you get pulled over, you had an eight ball of blow in the car. I've seen this before in their 20s. They're now in their 50s. They're entirely different people. Why should they have to carry that around as an albatross and not only have to carry it around, but be precluded from defending themselves? I just think it's unacceptable.
I do too. And it seems to me, I mean, maybe this, some might say this is pie in the sky, but it seems to me the record we're seeing coming out of the Supreme Court lately, I have kind of a good feeling about the outcomes on these out of the Supreme Court. What do you think?
Well, I actually have said on my video, and I'll be doing a little prediction special here in a few days. It depends on how broad the Supreme Court wants the rule here on the Rahimi case. there's a lot of procedural questions, because I don't think that anybody's going to argue that Mr. Rahimi should be in possession of firearms. Okay. He's exactly the kind of individual that we should take firearm rights from. The question in Rahimi, though, is what procedural method should we use to do that? We are stripping a person of their constitutional right, and we are doing so pre-conviction. And what sorts of procedural due process protections need to be in place? That's really the issue. The mainstream media has spun it like, oh, this is a bunch of gun nuts that want to give DV perpetrators their guns back. That is not what this lawsuit is about whatsoever, okay? And we do acknowledge that there is a long tradition in this country of disarming individuals who we have categorized as being dangerous. And I think felony violent offenders and domestic violence perpetrators fall into that category. The question is what types of procedural safeguards should we have in place so we're not just stripping people of their rights, you know, unnecessarily or unconstitutionally? That's the issue behind for Rahimi. And so I think the Supreme Court has a really, really tough decision ahead of it. And I just don't know how narrow they want to issue the ruling. I think if they structure a very narrow ruling and it really deals exclusively with Mr. Rahimi, the United States government's going to win. I think if get beyond that and they start getting into the procedural mechanisms, I think you'll see kind of a split decision where Rahimi's going to win on some grounds and lose on other grounds.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to keep an eye on this. Be sure that you subscribe to Washington Gun Law on YouTube, WashingtonGunLaw.com. If you need to get a hold of my guest, William Kirk, thank you very much for joining me here on the Brian McLean Show.
Thanks for having me, Brian. Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yes, it was wonderful. Stay tuned for Misty Winston coming up next on TNT Radio.